Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week is Water the New Oil, Part 2, with Dr. Seth Darling, plus a satiric song by Tom Lehrer. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week, we heard about the new mineral shortage of the 21st century, fresh water. It's long past time to get serious about conserving and protecting this vital resource, Dr. Seth Darling says. Water that's clean and pure enough to drink will be in ever shorter supply per capita. So, just as a start, maybe we shouldn't use pure drinking water to flush our toilets or spray on our lawns. We've been squandering fresh, clean water because, in the 20th century, water was abundant, safe, and cheap. Remember those three qualities: abundant, safe, and cheap. In the 21st century, we can have any two of the three, but not the third. We can have abundant and safe, but not cheap, safe and cheap, but not abundant, or abundant and cheap, but not safe. Choose your poison, as they say. But today, Darling takes an optimistic tack. He talks about purification techniques, some cutting-edge science at Argonne National Laboratory, and the huge and successful water projects done in Chicago over the last 130 years. We'll hear the rest of Darling's talk, then some relevant music by Tom Lehrer, and then a bit of Darling's Q&A. Forward we go.
As I said, we all feel like water should be cheap or maybe even free. But there's this great quote from Ben Franklin: when the well is dry, we learn the worth of water. Okay, so you came to hear some science. What is water? So that's water. What's the chemical formula for water? H2O. It's the one molecule everybody knows. But maybe there's something you didn't know about water. So this is what the molecule looks like. The O, oxygen, is the red guy in the middle. And the H, the two hydrogens, are on the two sides. What's important about this molecule is the way it's shaped. Those two hydrogen atoms are not in a straight line with the oxygen, with one on each side. They're both on the same side, like Mickey Mouse ears. And that's a really important thing about water, because oxygen likes negative charge more than the hydrogen does. And so the electrons that are flying around that molecule distribute themselves asymmetrically. There's more electrons on one side than on the other side. And so you get something called polarity, where the molecule is more positive over here and more negative over here. And that one aspect of water, the fact that it's polar, controls so many of the things, the interesting and important properties about water. For one thing, that's what allows microwave ovens to work. The reason they work is the microwaves come through and they cause those polar molecules to rotate and vibrate around, and that's what heats up your food. More importantly, water's polarity is what drives proteins to fold. So the proteins that make up you and me and every living thing on Earth are folded up in very complex ways, these big molecules. And all of those folding interactions are mediated by water. If it were not polar, this would not happen. There would be no life. Another strange thing about water's polarity is that it causes solid water, ice, to be less dense than liquid water, water. That is really unusual for a material. There are only a handful of examples of all the materials in the world that we know of where this is true, and water is one of them. That's why ice floats in your glass of water, because it's less dense than the water. And the same thing happens on Lake Michigan in the winter. This is important, that when it freezes in the winter, it freezes at some of the water, that ice sits on the top because it's less dense, and that serves as an insulating barrier to keep the entire lake from freezing during the winter, so you can have life in that water year-round. Again, without that, we might not have life on Earth at all. Another thing about water's polarity is that it makes it a fantastic solvent. Polar molecules are really good at dissolving stuff. So you can put all kinds of different things into water, and it'll stay there. And that is also really important for us. Pictured here in the background, way too small for you to see, is just a piece of the metabolism that happens inside our bodies. There are thousands and thousands, probably millions, of different chemicals inside us, going through all kinds of different chemical reactions all the time inside our cells. And all of them are dissolved in water. That's the solvent. So all of those things need to be dissolved by just one thing. But the fact that it's a great solvent has an unfortunate side effect, which means it's very easy to pollute. It can dissolve the stuff we want, but it also dissolves all kinds of stuff you don't want to stay in the water. Heavy metals, all those micropollutants I was talking about, and plenty of other things. Once they get in the water, they stay in the water. Okay, so that's some bad. A good news piece of water is that you can't use up water. The water that's on Earth has been here since long before we were here, and it'll be here long after we're all gone. There are still competing theories about where all the water came from originally on Earth. Extraterrestrial sources are recognized as probably one of the significant original sources, but that all happened way early in our planet's history, and that water just keeps going around through a cycle, right? You learned about this in grade school, where water evaporates and then it rains down, and it just keeps going through a cycle. So it's the same water. What that means is that every molecule of water in every glass that you drink has at some point in its life been inside an oak tree, it's been blasted out by a volcano, and it's been urinated by a dinosaur. Which sounds gross, that we're all drinking dinosaur pee. But what that actually tells you is another important thing about water, which is that no matter how dirty you make it, it can always be cleaned again. It doesn't matter what you put in that water, you can get it back out again if you put in the right effort. So, clean water. What does that mean to say water is clean? That's actually a really complicated question because, as I said, you can put all kinds of different things into water. And you might say, well, let's just take it all out. So all that's left is H2O. You don't want that. You don't want to drink that. That's actually poison, pure water. It'll leach out nutrients from your body. So you don't want it to be that clean. The point is, you want the water to be the appropriate cleanliness for the application that it's going to be used. If you're going to drink it, you want it to be pretty clean. You don't want viruses or heavy metals or certain things in there. But you do need some minerals to be in there, like I said, so it's actually not unhealthy to drink. There are other things where the water can be dirtier. If you're just going to water your lawn, it doesn't need to be drinking water quality. Or, on the flip side, if you're going to manufacture semiconductors, like what's inside your smartphones and laptops and all that, you do need that water to be ultra, ultra clean, cleaner than drinking water. In fact, much cleaner than drinking water. So, in fact, the most state-of-the-art water purification plants in the world are at semiconductor manufacturing. So the idea here is you make the right water for the right purpose. It's called fit for use. And again, the ancient Romans did this a long time ago. It's time to start doing it again. So how do you clean water? There are lots of ways to clean water. This is just a few examples. There are more. So one way is you can do media filtration. This is an old school technique. You basically have a big barrel of sand, and you just pour your dirty water over the top and let it come out the bottom. And it's not the sand per se that's doing the cleaning. On the sand grows a biofilm with lots of little bacteria and stuff in it that chew up a lot of the bad stuff that's in the water. So as it percolates through, it gets cleaned up. What happens in most of our municipal plants is that mouthful up at the top there, coagulation, flocculation, sedimentation, filtration, which I won't go through the time to describe what that whole process is, but that's how most of our municipal water gets cleaned. Under your kitchen sink, you might have something that looks like that picture over on the right-hand side, membrane filtration. And in fact, that's an area where most of the exciting research, at least in my view, in water technology is these days, is in membrane filtration. I think there are great opportunities to push that technology forward. Other techniques that are out there are things like distillation. This is where you basically boil the water and then recondense it, and then it comes out much cleaner than it was before and leaves behind all the impurities. And you can also disinfect water just to get rid of the pathogens. You can do that with chlorination, dumping in chlorine. That's what we do in most of our municipal systems. You can also do it with ultraviolet light, like what's pictured there, which in some places in the developing world is also used in municipal water treatment systems. So this brings me back to the issue of our oceans. I told you We don't have a water shortage. It's just that most of it is in the oceans. We do know how to take seawater and make fresh water. It's a process called desalination, and it's come a long way. People have gotten pretty good at desalination. But I want to give you a sense for the scale of the problem here. This is a plot of the global capacity for desalination by year. So the units here are millions of cubic meters per day that are processed in desalination. And you can see every year the capacity grows. We're building more and more desalination plants. So that's great. And it's maybe not surprising the countries that are leading the way here are places like Israel and United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and places that are near salt water and are very dry. But let me tell you the scale of the problem here. Look where we are today. Top of that scale is 140 in these units, right? So I'm going to take that graph and I'm just going to squish it down. That's our global water use. So you can see how far we have to go if we're going to try and use this to solve our problem. That's not going to get us out of this mess anytime soon. An awful long way to go. Okay. So you may not realize, but here in Chicagoland, we actually have a long history of very impressive water engineering. Long time ago, if you walked out on the streets of Chicago back in the 1800s, it was a really gross place to be. There was sewage on the streets, horse manure and so on. Just, it was awful. And for a city aspiring to be a growing metropolitan center, that was not acceptable. So the idea would be water sanitation. You want to put that sewage into sewer lines instead of just out on the street. The problem with Chicago is that because of the soil conditions, you couldn't dig under the buildings and put in sewer lines. It wasn't feasible. So what did Ellis Chesbro do? He thought, well, I'm going to give Chicago the first sewer system in the United States. No city had it before this. And crazy thought, he said, all right, we can't go under the city. Let's lift up the city. And that's actually what they did. They put jacks under all the buildings and jacked them up and built the sewers underneath. Unbelievable. But they did it, and it worked. So that solved one problem, because now the sewage wasn't on the streets anymore. But you know where those sewers dumped? Into the Chicago River. Where did the Chicago River go? Into Lake Michigan. That's where our drinking water was coming from. Still is coming from. So we were just dumping raw sewage into our drinking water, and people started getting sick. So you might think, well, let's just dump our sewage somewhere else, but no, no, not in Chicago. They said, we're just going to make the Chicago River go the other way. And that's what they did. They actually came in and reversed the flow of the Chicago River, dumped a lot of that nasty stuff into what's now the Sanitarian Ship Canal, which actually runs right by Argonne National Laboratory, and, you know, solved the problem, so to speak. But our great water engineering didn't stop there. There's a more recent example at an even larger scale, I would say. So we have this other problem in Chicago that our sewer system is called a combined system, where we use the same lines to handle what comes out of our house as waste and what goes down the storm drains. For those who've lived in Chicago a long time, you're familiar with when there's a big storm, you get too much water going into that system for the treatment plant to handle, and the whole thing backs up, and it comes up in your basement as untreated sewage, which is not fun for anyone who's experienced it. So enough taxpayers finally got fed up with this that they created what you've probably heard of as the deep tunnel, although maybe you've never seen pictures of it. The official name for it is the Tunnel and Reservoir Plan, or TARP plan. But there's this network of tunnels that are massive. Look at the scale here. That's a guy, to give you a sense for how big this tunnel is. And there's a whole bunch of these things under our city which handle this massive flow when there's a big storm that the treatment plant can't handle as fast as it's coming in. And all those tunnels then dump out into places like this. This is Thornton Quarry. Look at the scale here again. Those are trucks. The people there, you can't even see. They're so tiny. That's, I think, the tri-state right up there at the top. This is the largest such reservoir in the world, I believe. So all that water gets tunneled down, dumped into there, and it'll sit there until the treatment plants can catch up and process all that mess and get you back to the normal state of affairs. So we've been thinking about big-scale water engineering in Chicago essentially as long as there's been a Chicago. Let me bring it home a little more, though, to Argonne. There is a sizable but rapidly growing program in water research at Argonne which very much is in partnership with the University of Chicago, in fact, principally through the Institute for Molecular Engineering, which is a joint institute between these two great research organizations. So just a few examples of the sort of types of work that are going on in water. One would be, I told you a little earlier about how important policy is, things like virtual water not being policed really at all today. The policymakers need to have the right information to understand what policies to put into place, and that's something that smart scientists and engineers can provide. We're also looking at connections between water and the environment in many ways, and food. So top three challenges we face as a society are energy, water, and food. And they're all connected with each other. It's not just a water-energy nexus, it's a water-energy-food nexus. We can get a lot smarter. So you guys answered correctly about where most of our water is used, not withdrawn. Most of it's withdrawn for the power plants, but most of it is used for agriculture. So that's where, if you're going to try and save some water, that's a good place to turn. And we're not very smart about the way we water our crops. We basically just dump water across an entire farm, more or less the same. What you can do instead is something called site-specific crop management, or precision agriculture, where you go in and you deliver just the right amount of water to even each plant, and just at the right spot by its roots. The Israelis are really good at this already. This is something that we're learning much more about. Another interesting topic of research at Argonne is groundwater dating. So I told you earlier about groundwater and fossil water and how a lot of it's been down there for a really long time. How do you know how long that water's been down there to know how quickly an aquifer is getting replenished? It's actually a really hard question to answer. So the way that we're trained in school that you date old things is carbon dating, right? That's what's used for old human artifacts. Carbon dating doesn't work for things that are hundreds of thousands or even millions of years old. You need some other technique. And so at Argonne, they developed something called atom trap trace analysis to use krypton dating, and they've actually gone and started dating different aquifers, and they can tell you this one is, 600,000 years old, and that one is 200,000 years old. Really important information. We're also developing all kinds of advanced materials technologies to tackle problems of pollution. In my own group, we're doing things to, for example, clean up oil spills with some advanced materials, and developing, I told you, membranes are where most of the exciting new water technology is coming. We're developing all kinds of advanced membrane technologies at Argonne that clean themselves and effectively filter out pathogens and all kinds of other things. Okay. So we face a lot of huge societal challenges. There's climate change, there's income inequality in our financial system, and so on and so forth. A lot of these big challenges, it's really hard to muster affection for them. The financial system, and maybe the University of Chicago is the wrong place to say this, but it's really hard to muster affection about the financial system. But our affection for water is something that we're born with. We are all so connected to water that people love water. It is who we are, literally. And water's invisibility, I said, is bad for us and for water. The fact that we have this innate affection for it is good for us and for water. And we need to start reevaluating water's importance. It's important for our foreign policy, our food, the environment around us, public health, our national security, and as I told you, it's intimately connected to energy. It connects to our lives in so many different ways. So water may be invisible, but I would encourage you to start seeing water. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Time was when an American about to go abroad would be warned by his friends or the guidebooks not to drink the water. But times have changed, and now a foreigner coming to this country might be offered the following advice.
Visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware: don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just Just go out for a breath of air, and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe, long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They are drinking the water and breathing the air.
Tom Lehrer with a song from 1965, Pollution, reminding us how little has changed in the past 50 years. Now, fast forward to 2016. Here's a bit of the Q&A following Darling's talk.
I was aware of the technology of desalination, but I'm concerned. How is that economically feasible? And what do you think about the future to make it more economically feasible for poor countries in Africa and South Asia?
Okay, so desalination. So I mentioned one thing is that we've got a long way to go with it in terms of scale, right? So it's very important in places like Israel, for example, but globally the scale is essentially irrelevant at this point. So let me talk about technology and science first with desalination. So you can calculate by just the laws of physics, thermodynamics, how much energy it takes to take the salt out of seawater to give you drinking water. It's some amount of energy. And it used to be, you know, a few decades ago, that the desalination technology was a long way away from that limit. When they would use, there are still plants operating in places like Saudi Arabia that essentially do distillation. It's very energy intensive. But the state-of-the-art plants, reverse osmosis plants, which is what people are building today, are so good that they're actually approaching those fundamental limits and how efficient it could ever be. So there's actually no breakthrough coming in energy savings for desalination. And by the way, that is what limits how much you can desalinate. You talk about the cost. That's where the cost is primarily, is in the energy to build up the pressure to shove the salt water through those membranes and get the salt out. And energy just costs money. So there's no breakthrough coming there. It's never going to get a lot cheaper than it is today. It'll get a little bit cheaper as people get a little better at it, but there's no breakthrough there. What I just said is true for seawater, but the story changes for brackish water, which is less salty water. And there's a lot of brackish water on Earth in aquifers, for example. Many places where there's fossil fuels, there's also water, but the water's a little salty. Not as salty as seawater, but it's too salty to drink. And desalinating that, there's all kinds of exciting technological innovations that are yet to be made. There's all kinds of room for improvement there. So don't give up on desalination altogether. I'm just saying there's not a breakthrough in seawater desalination. In terms of cost, the Israelis pay more for water than we do because it's expensive to desalinate because of the energy. And there's really no way around that. What I would argue, though, is we're not actually paying as much for water here as we should be. There's not really intelligent water pricing much of anywhere on Earth today, which I tried to allude to a few times. That will help us start making smarter decisions with how we use water if it has an appropriate price on it. The flip side of that is you can argue that water is a human right. You can't charge people for water if they can't afford to buy enough to live. That's inhuman. And so how do you balance those two things? And there's another issue. Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, University of Chicago, we can talk about this, that, you know, uses market forces to try and solve your problem. So you come up with a price, and you say that's the price, and then let the market solve your problem. But all that does is make sure that we humans share our water in a certain way that maybe makes sense. The problem is we're not the only ones who need water. The ecosystem around us needs water, too. The rest of the Earth needs a lot of water to grow the trees and all the other things that happen on Earth that need water, all the other organisms. And they don't pay water bills. So there has to be another hand that comes in with Adam Smith's invisible hand, a green hand, if you will, that represents, you know, the Lorax, speaks for the trees.
I have a question for you. Who cares? You know, so we, you know, you've alluded to the crisis that we've all heard about in Flint. The World Health Organization came out with a statement that reverse osmosis systems are actually really bad in their current form, perhaps, for health. And in fact, there are stories out there of children drinking formula based on reverse osmosis systems who actually got really sick. The city of Chicago school system finally came out and said, oh, no, we haven't been testing for lead. So my question is, and who cares? So you've been in this field. Can you tell us who cares?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, that's you're all here because you care, right? So this is something we're trying to spread the word about, is the importance of water. That's why I'm up here talking and why I give other talks just like this, is that I think you're right, that this is a crisis that certainly the folks of Flint are feeling acutely right now, but in other parts of the world, as I mentioned, children are dying every day because they're consuming water that's not been cleaned, and that should not be acceptable to any of us. And that is a crisis of leadership, but who elects those leadership? That's us. So it's all of our fault. It's all of our responsibility to fix this.
Scientist Seth Darling, speaking at the University of Chicago on May 18, 2016. I have gently edited and slightly condensed the original audio recording. And for sending that original recording our way, let us thank again non-commercial radio guy Dale Lehman, out Windy City way. Tempus fugit, and so must we. If you missed part one of Darling's talk, or any other show of ours, you can grab it on MP3 from our website, which is, and I quote, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non-carborundum, let's try to live each day as though the truth were true, and, as Mom used to say, I'd be tickled pink if you tuned in again next week. Ciao.